medicinal plants and horticultural crops. So that's tomorrow at 4 p.m. in the Jefferson West, which is right over here. Okay? So it'll be good because I'm going to limit people to very short talks so we can have a really long time to discuss how we can improve propagation methods and production methods. Because it's not quite as easy as, you know, sowing some of the common crops that people are growing for large-scale production. So, okay. So I actually started working a lot more in Arabidopsis as a plant biologist, and I've moved into crops and medicinal plants. So what I'm going to just show you here is the focus of my research as an entity is really phenylalanine production and how we can use phenylalanine to boost or reduce specific chemicals in a particular plant type. So in Arabidopsis, our genetic model, we focused on the interrupted dehydrogenase. This particular gene and subsequent the protein does have both the characteristics of the bacterial protein that makes phenylalanine, and that it can act on two different substrates to produce phenylalanine. One's inducible and one seems constitutive. I'm not going to actually go into that biochemistry unless there's time at the end if somebody has a question about that. But the reason why that's important is the phenylalanine embolus that I look at in the seed-to-season transition is an inducible aspect. So we use a lot of different abiotic stimuli, and we've also looked at biotic stimuli as well, but much more abiotic stimuli, to try to alter the amount of phenylalanine produced so we could change certain chemical groups in very young seedlings. So when you go from a seed to a seedling, you're going from a heterotrophic embryo to an autotrophic seedling. So I look at it just a 2 to 3 day period before the chloroplast is fully developed and producing phenylalanine in the chloroplast, which does once it gets to full synthetic competency. I'm interested in the seed-to-seedling transition because if we keep plants in the dark just a couple days, or we use different abiotic stimuli in that period, we can really manipulate the phenylpropanoid pathway. And that seems to, for our purposes, is a good thing that we want to apply to try to produce specific chemicals that might have some medicinal purpose. So, briefly, this slide, I can have to move this a little bit so I can see it because I don't have to crane my neck around and look at the projection there. What I'm going to focus on is very young tissue in general, and when we did our propagation experiments where we would cut off leaves or parts of different plants in the Brassicaceae, we wanted to see if we could get in the new growth changes in the phenylpropanoids in those exact tissues. So we're trying to farm specific phenylpropanoid types. So ADTH3 is the protein that I work on, and it does have a homologue in almost every genome that we've looked at. And this is a protein that makes phenylalanine before the chloroplast is fully developed. And the reason why we're very interested in that is you can see here, we have a pointer. Okay, so I'm going to walk over here, and my voice is going to drop out, but I want to point this on here because it's kind of faint, where the phenylalanine embolus sort of occurs and where it actually flows to. So those kind of dotted lines with the arrow is through the vasculature we can see on the microscope phenylalanine, labeled phenylalanine, actually going into various cell types as leaves are starting to expand and they're building the chloroplast. Phenylalanine is coming from the shoot apical meristem and also being heavily produced in the leaf primordia. So the big arrow at the bottom of the seedling, which you don't have to walk over there because I think you can see the arrows, is phenylalanine also can be synthesized in the very tip of the roots. Even under soil, light hitting the expanding leaves will cause synthesis of phenylalanine in the roots. Don't know exactly how it happens, but clearly there's some communication between the leaves and the roots. So there's two main areas where phenylalanine is produced, in the root tips and also in the shoot apical meristem. And we focus more on the shoot apical meristem because we're most concerned about leaves and phenylpropanoid made them leave. So we've done a number of phenylalanine and phenylpropanoid studies on reactive oxygen species, on making particular chemicals from phenylalanine that are really good scavengers of free radicals, but also good screeners of UV. So we've done a lot of analytical chemistry on some of the chemicals we've managed to induce in Arabidopsis, but also other plants. So this is the main reason why I mentioned phenylalanine, is it does have a lot of effects in the young developing plant that really were not well reported on. Most people know phenylpropanoids are important in structure, they're important in defense, but within the last couple of years, we've published a couple of papers that show they're critical in other activities as well that are not intuitive. And not directly a result of being made into phenylpropanoids. Okay, so phenylalanine, for example, analogs of phenylalanine that are not metabolites or anti-metabolites, they actually can directly scavenge reactive oxygen species without being synthesized into a flavonoid or another phenylpropanoid. Okay, so what we've been interested in doing as kind of a long-term goal is looking at plants in the Brassicaceae that might be excellent reducers of cellular stress, partly because we did most of our basic studies in Arabidopsis, but we also did some initial studies in broccoli seedlings, and about 22 years ago, the Colony Lab produced data on broccoli that tocilizumab was an excellent anti-cancer. Anti-cancer possible treatment, and it could be that the factor of chemicals in broccoli seedlings and maybe other brassica seedlings might be useful for us in looking at further at different anti-inflammatory. So anti-inflammatories are what we're very interested in because inflammation is one of the major routes to chronic pain. I'm trying to find something that you know, some chemicals that would be non-addictive and animal wouldn't develop tolerance to, a mammal wouldn't develop tolerance to, and pain is very important. At least, you know, that's what the government keeps saying to the press, that they care about opioid addiction. I don't see the money yet really coming through the different agencies to address it. There is one NIH program that's active now, but I wish there was more, because I think herbs and medicinal plants actually would have quite a fertile ground to be looking through the different compounds where we still don't understand why they're good anti-inflammatories and they're not opiates. So what we did for a number of the brassica, I want to talk about a couple of different plants today, is that we decided to do a genetic method but also a natural sort of organic method of trying to produce anti-inflammatory compounds. So I'm going to show one here and talk about the other at the same time, is that we use DMS recombination to create heavy deletions in a common broccoli cultivar. We did a lot of stress tests because we wanted to make sure that these mutants could survive standard sort of abiotic stimuli, and whatever survived that is what we grew up and we started vegetatively propagating because broccoli is self-incompatible. So we didn't have the advantage that we could actually self all of our different mutants. We ended up with more than 100 lines and about 70 lines that had good. My time here. I have a stopwatch too. Okay. It's getting so exciting that I end up going over time. Try not to do that. So we had from an initial over, I think I had 600,000 or maybe 650,000 seeds of this initial EMS recombination. That we had 74 lines that were, we couldn't kill them basically from all the abiotic heavy duty stimuli that we used, and they have very high production of phenylpropanoids of different types. So some of them had super thick cuticles and were almost like they looked like plastic. They were so thick. And others were kind of thin and flimsy, but they had very concentrated types of flavonoids. So we have a number of different phenotypes to look at. We did some chemical analytical chemistry and analyzed the species and the different types of, particularly polyphenols, some polyamines, and some of the simitates from certain types of plants that we looked at. There's about 6 different species. And then we got to the point where we wanted to do in vitro testing, and we realized it would be very time consuming, and multiplexing plates are extremely expensive, like many thousands of dollars. So we actually just went direct mice and did some in vivo tests to look at alleviating or preventing pain. So our pain scale, obviously mice can't tell us, but there is sort of a pain scale diagram shown here at the bottom of, if our treatment given 30 minutes before formal impact in the paw, which causes irritation and pain. But what mice do is different behaviors that show something hurts, or something, if they don't lick their paw or cradle it or kind of hop on it, or if it's not red and swollen, well, then it doesn't hurt. So we got very good results with 3 different lines of our broccoli, and pretty good results from some Brussels sprouts extracts that we were also testing. They're much harder to grow than our broccoli seedlings, so focusing more on broccoli. So I just want to show a little bit of what we did is that some of the lines of the parentals, because these are the lines from that were genetically damaged by EMS recombination, and then we vegetatively propagated, and we took out leaf discs and did analytical chemistry on new leaf growth before the leaves were fully expanded. And we also analyzed seeds of different types of broccoli as well. So what we're trying to do is that we're not so sure if we want to work with mutagenized seed lines. They're problematic in different ways. And we tried to find an abiotic protocol of using just non-mutated broccoli seeds to try to produce the same chemical output, so the same chemotype. And that took about a year and a half, and we finally found a couple of cultivars that actually, under a series of different abiotic stimuli, different cold and UV and heat treatments, we actually could get that output of material. So we can do it in a non-GMO way or a GMO way. So we just wanted to try to do that, because obviously there's problematic. The public is not very accepting of GMOs, so what we're trying to do is see if we can do it without resorting to genetic modification. What I want to point out is, in Arabidopsis, one thing that we saw that we also see in other brassica is, in addition to seeing interesting phenylpropanoids, which I'll show some structures in a second here, is we found that there was one chemical that after liver microsomal digestion, and this is published in Scientific Reports in sort of maybe mid to end of 2016, Gura et al., we found that this chemical here, it's right in the middle, so I'm going to go point it out here.
Is a polyamine that quite often is a defensive chemical for seeds. So it's interesting that this was actually boosted after liver metabolism, mammalian liver metabolism, as being a main constituent in an extract that we made from Arabidopsis mutants. We tried different mutants that produced very high levels of polyphenols. So we did find some similar structures in broccoli as well. So we're going to continue to follow that up, because ordinarily this chemical is generally found in seeds, not in older plant growth. So we think it may be a stress response, but it seems to contribute to the potent anti-inflammatory effect, because the post-liver microsomal extracts actually are much more effective than pre. So we're interested in quercetins and camphorols that are associated with different sugars, because that makes them much more water-soluble. But it also, the downside is it is not so bioavailable. So what we did find is that when we had chemicals together, if I'm going to skip ahead here, if we had a mix of cytopates and polyphenols of the flavonoid class together, we actually found that we got much better anti-inflammatory effect than if we used individual flavonoids. So this has been a consistent problem with a lot of medical studies where they focus on a single chemical. The single chemicals are not a silver bullet to be dealing with inflammation, which is a multi-component sort of process. And maybe that's what we have to do for pain research, is we have to look at extracts that have multiple compounds to get a better broad spectrum effect to reduce inflammation, which is a major component of pain. So I just want to say that also in our phenylalanine studies, using different amounts of phenylalanine, we could actually preferentially boost flavonoids over other chemicals. That makes sense because phenylalanine is a bottleneck to that pathway. But the interesting thing is we could put much more into the leaves by feeding the plants at very specific times. Okay, so that's where we're at now is we're trying to look at feeding regimens with phenylalanine and also abiotic treatments to see how we can maximize the polyphenols and the polyamines that seem to contribute to this anti-inflammatory effect. So thank you very much, and I want to acknowledge the basic science work is funded by NSF. We also got some awards that for international students and also innovation awards to work on this work. Mark Krakowski, Nyfarth Nyboth, both undergrads contributed mostly to this work, as well as Carlos Montero, who's now a medical student. So thank you very much.
Kate, let's give her a hand.